We have two sessions today. The first session was a joint committee meeting, which included portfolios on public enterprise, economic development, and transport. We are then meeting, we adjourned for lunch, and we came back to, as now, the Portfolio Committee on Transport to deal with item number two on our agenda, which is the briefing by the Department of Transport on the Norfolk Police. I would want to welcome in our meeting the former chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, Comrade Jeremy Cronin, who is now our Deputy Minister. We welcome you. We hope that we will learn a lot from you, and we think we are picking up on the legacy that you left in the Portfolio Committee. I would also want to welcome the department official that are here with us, led by, can I call you with first name, Maria? Okay. And all the members of the Portfolio Committee, the officials and members of the public present. I think we are starting a very short year, which requires us to be very focused. We cannot afford to postpone any of the meetings because the year is very short, and there are lots of issues that we need to process. I'm going to explain what is going to be happening today. We are going to be briefed on the Norfolk policy. At this stage, it is still a policy that will then inform the legislation, which would then follow the usual procedure of us having to process the policy when it becomes a bill. At the moment, it is not a bill, it is still a policy. And we are briefed for purposes of making us understand what it entails, so that by the time it is published, we are able to explain to whoever who is asking us. There isn't any decision that is required of us to take today in as far as the policy is concerned. And then the third agenda on our item is the adoption of the previous minutes. And I had also expected that there was going to be a program which we would also need to adopt. Yes, the first term program. Yes. Item number three is the consideration and adoption of previous minutes, and also the adoption of the first term program. Those are the three things that we shall be doing today. I will then hand over to the department to make a presentation. Oh, before we do that, we have a new committee secretary. His name is Tenda Madima. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. It's nice to be here, not there, in your position, and it's nice also to see many familiar faces from the Portfolio Committee. What we want to do from this side of the Department of Transport is, first of all, I will just give a brief overview and background and some sense of the process, which you've already begun to touch on. And then Dr. Maria Kurtz, and the team, our colleagues from the department, will then give a sort of overview in slightly more detail with a PowerPoint presentation of some of the key features of the policy on no fault. So if that's in order, Chairperson, then that's how we proceed. Okay, that's in order to proceed like that. Yeah, I think the first thing to say is what we're dealing with here is a very complicated challenge. And it's a challenge that's been with us as a country since 1942, when the motor vehicle accident insurance scheme was first introduced. In 1996, this parliament transformed that into what is currently called the Road Accident Fund. But fundamentally, the legal framework and institutional framework has remained pretty much unchanged. But in time, the problems have grown and augmented, and we are currently sitting, I think, on a very, very serious crisis in terms of providing assistance to the tens of thousands of people who every year are seriously injured on our roads, to the families of the, on average, some 15,000 people who are killed in road accidents, and so on. We've got a major challenge. Now, I think that the members have got the document, the substantial document, which is about 90 pages. There is, in my view, quite a useful executive summary of about 12 pages in Roman numbers. And that provides an excellent summary. I'd obviously urge you to read the entire document, but it is useful to have a good sense of what it's all about by looking at that executive summary. And part of what that executive summary says is it begins by listing the challenges that we've got now. The first obvious one is that the current road accident fund is unsustainable in its present form. The actuaries tell us that on its books, in terms of claims, they estimate that there is something like 41 billion rand worth of claims on the fund parked there. It's of that order, so it's enormous. And there's no way that we can continue to fund, and it's growing from year to year, partly as a result of increasing levels of accident, injury, and fatality on our roads, but also because we've made the fund more accessible, and that is certainly part of government policy, to make sure that we are more available, more accessible, that the terrible limits, there were some racialized limits on access, for instance, people in public transport couldn't claim beyond a minimal amount, and we've lifted that ceiling, and that's absolutely correct in terms of equity and the kind of new South Africa that we're trying to develop. But of course, the consequence of that has been the further burgeoning of these claims. So as I say, it's of the order of something like 41 billion that we estimate. The second problem, and these things are all interconnected, precisely this issue that you've asked us to talk fundamentally about, and that's the fault-based nature of the Road Accident Fund. Now, having sat in this committee and listened over 10 years to inputs and so on, to be honest, it took me a little bit of time to understand some of these complexities. I came into the committee not understanding what the Road Accident Fund was at all. But essentially, what we mean by fault-based is that your claim depends on your ability, getting the claim depends on your ability to prove that you were not at fault in an accident. Typically in accidents, they're not always clear cut, and sometimes there are degrees of fault on both sides if there are two parties involved. 10% on one side and 90% on the other and so forth. So it ends up in a very complicated process. Which has then become very legally based. So it takes a long, long time to process claims because there's an obligation on the side of the fund to make sure that it's not just in terms of the law that governs it, that it's not just dispensing money in terms of its needs to establish the degree of fault. Obviously, on the side of the claimant also, they seek to establish that. And that means that what we've got is a very legally based system. And the figures, the disputed figures, but certainly a very high proportion of the money that we collect from the fuel levy. So the fund is resourced out of the fuel levy. And I think last year we collected about 8.5 billion rands worth of money out of the fuel levy. The Statutory Commission, when it met, calculated that only 50% of that, roughly, of those billions of rand that are collected from the fuel levy end up actually in moving out in terms of compensation. And a large amount of it ends up in professional fees. Many of those professional fees are lawyers' fees. Others are health professionals. So we have neurosurgeons and others who are not doing brain surgery, but who are busy preparing legal cases for the court. And typically also there's a pattern that these cases are not settled, don't finally make it to court. They get court time, a time is allocated to the court case. I understand that here in the Cape Town High Court, there's something like 11,000 road accident fund cases jamming up the court roll. And then what happens very typically is that the matter is settled on the steps of the court. Okay. Now, that might be out of bad faith or good faith, but it means that lawyers can claim large amount of time in terms of working on the case. It means that neurosurgeons and specialists like that are parked into these processes, lined up to give specialists with evidence and so on. They're not actually doing what we want them to do, which is to assist patients in hospital. It means also that, for instance, if your family, if your breadwinner is killed in an accident, the long time that it takes to get a claim, to get an award, means that a family is left on its own for years at a time waiting for some kind of settlement. And then the whole system is focused also on a lump sum award. So you make a claim for, it varies obviously, but for 3 or 4 or 5 billion, and so the dispute between the fund and its lawyers and the claimant and his or her lawyers typically surrounds a claim around getting a lump sum award. And the problem with lump sums is that they also have all kinds of unintended consequences. So you focus on trying to prove 3 years later that you've been very seriously disabled. So you might be even perversely inclined to remain as disabled as possible in order to increase the lump sum payment. And it means that the whole focus is not on rehabilitation, on immediate care, and so on. The focus tends to be on zama-zama, on getting a big payout. And obviously the litigious and lawyer-based realities of the system tend to feed into that as well, because then lawyers draw a percentage of the award and so forth. And there's a long list of challenges. Another obvious one is that I think one of the outstanding achievements of post-1994 in South Africa has been the very extensive elaboration and extension of the social security net. So, millions more people, I think, what is the figure? I forget the figure, but it was, I think that 2 or 3 million people in 1994 had some kind of social security access. It's now 11 or 12 million people that have access to social security. But that means also now that we're running into increasing challenges around double dipping in terms of unemployment insurance, for instance, around COHIDA, which is the compensation for injury and disease, occupational injury and disease, that often we have a sense that people are drawing for the same thing, for the same injury, for instance. not properly institutionally integrated into the social security net that we've got, and therefore we think that there's quite a lot of fraud, and part of that fraud in the system has to do with double dipping people, you know, getting two different payments. Then if you've got the document, you will see that some other issues are also mentioned, and one's just highlighting some of the big problems that we've got. On Roman 3 of the executive summary, somewhere in the middle there, it points out that there's also a distortion in the nature of the claims that we're getting at the fund. It says that a substantial proportion of the fuel levy is spent on claimants with only slight injuries on the one hand, and on other, and in another respect, on high income earners. So it says a small number of claims result in the highest payout. Just over 2% of the RAF claims exceed over $500,000 per individual claim. But those 2% of claims account for about 41% of claim payments. So there are all kinds of obvious distortions in the way in which the claim system currently works as well. And then finally, I'll draw your attention in terms of some of the perversities and problems and challenges in the current system to Roman 4 of the executive summary. And if you look at that table, which is in the middle of the page, there's an analysis of legal costs versus medical compensation paid over those years, 1998 to 2008. And if you just go to the end, 2008. So in 2008, the fund, which is the last year that for which we got comprehensive figures, the total legal costs paid out by the fund were estimated to be $2 billion. Okay. The total medical costs, however, were just $776 million. So we're paying a fund that is designed basically to assist people who've been seriously injured in road accidents, is actually paying almost three times more on legal costs than it's paying into the healthcare system. And I also understand that we've got a precise figure, but we think that perhaps of that $776 million that goes into medical costs, probably about 10% of it goes into the public healthcare system. So our huge number of road accidents, fatalities, and so forth, is a huge burden on the healthcare system as well. But the money is not going into assisting to relieve the burden on our healthcare system, money that is actually should be designed precisely for that. So that gives you just a flavor of some of the huge issues that we're facing with this fund. Now, it's not as though we've been unaware of all of this. Stuart will recall over the last 10 years, well, previous 10 years, how we've been grappling with these matters. And in 2002, the Road Accident Fund Commission, the so-called Satchel Commission, produced, what was it, a three-volume, but a very substantial report, which is the basis on which we are still working in many respects. And it said that it identified all of these problems and many others in the current legal dispensation and the current Road Accident Fund. And it recommended that we should move away from the fault-based system to a no-fault system, to what it called a benefit scheme. So in other words, we should collect money basically from the fuel levy and use that money to assist people who have been seriously injured in car accidents and to assist the families of of breadwinners, for instance, who have been killed in road fatalities. That's what we need to focus on. By being over-focused on who's at fault and the degree of fault and so on, we've introduced that light at the heart of all of these other perversities. It's not the only challenge we've got, but that light at the heart of it. So we need to move away, the Satchel Commission said, to a system in which we basically pay out benefits to people who've been injured and to families whose breadwinners have been. And we should do that as a comprehensive social security, part of the social insurance system. And Satchel further recommended that it should then also be located within the social security net. we're not quite. We haven't. We think it was in about 2005. The previous cabinet agreed in principle with these recommendations that we should move to a no-fault system. But I think for whatever reasons, not much progress then was made beyond that. I should also point out that the Taylor Commission, which was another commission which was meeting, I think, in about, reported perhaps in about 2002 or so, 2003, which was looking at the social security system that we've got in South Africa, pointed out the many gaps and anomalies in that system, also picked up on this thing of the Road Accident Fund and also recommended that it should be transformed into a road accident benefit scheme and that it should form part and parcel of a comprehensive social security net. Okay. So the policy's there, and previous cabinets have agreed in principle to those policies. Until now, we haven't really made substantial progress, and I think that has to do just with the complexity of this area. And also, I think that we also expended a lot of energy on just trying to sort out the existing road accident fund. There were management problems and other challenges there as well, and I think that many of those have been resolved. And in resolving those, what comes up now more clearly is the fact that it's not just an internal management issue in the road accident fund. It's not that we need to be better run and more efficient, and no doubt that's the case. There's a systemic and structural problem, and that's what we've got to address. So what we've now finally got, which we're very proud about, and which we're proudly tabling today here in Parliament, is the draft policy. It's a discussion document which we're releasing, and it basically outlines what has been agreed by Cabinet, agreed late last year, but we decided to hold it back so we didn't release it publicly over the festive season and then be accused of trying to put something through past people without proper consultation and, you know, in the full light of. We will publish this document, which we made available to you today, formally in the Government Gazette next Friday, Friday the 12th, okay? But we wanted to begin here in Parliament so that we made it available first here in Parliament. So that's policy. This is the policy document, and Maria will speak to it in a moment. Just then to talk about how we are seeing the process. A discussion document which we're putting out from the department side, published then in the Government Gazette in a week and a half time on Friday next week. We will then call for any public comments that people might want to make. We will also proactively, from our side as government, reach out to key sectors that we think could, you know, would have interesting and important things to say about the document. And then we hope to close that process by the end of April, mid-April, end of April. Once that's done and once we've digested, and I should say the consultation process within government has been extensive, that has already happened, so with the obvious departments like social development, like health, and critically always, of course, Treasury, and then with other related departments. So we've had a comprehensive consultation with them, and so this is a collective government position with the Department of Transport being the lead department. Once we've received comments and so forth and interaction on the policy document that we're tabling today, closing in April, we will then move on the basis of the document, perhaps, you know, obviously amended here and there according to comments and so on that we get. That will then be used as the basis on which we begin the much more complicated task of trying to turn this into a draft legislation. Obviously, also, while we're doing that, we would need to look at institutional preparing so that we don't pass legislation, but don't have the institutional things in place and the funding in place and so on. The reason why we're coming to you today is, there's a question, is that you are going to be absolutely critical to this process as this portfolio committee. We can't go on stalling the shift, in our view, from fault to no fault. legislation. We're not going to be able to do it, we don't think, this year. And as the chair was saying, it's a foreshortened year because of 2010 and so on. But we really hope to bring draft legislation to you as a bill next year. And we are, I think this is exciting work because we can really make a big difference, really change things. But it's complicated. It's a very complicated area, and there are lots of vested interests, obviously, as well. So it will be a complicated process. So we hope that, and obviously it's for the committee to make up its mind, but we hope that there will be broad support in general, not necessarily for all this detail, but there's much detail that needs to be debated, broad support for where we're trying to go as government, in line with the Central Commission and in particular. And that that you will gear up and we will interact dynamically with you so that we hit the ground running when, as soon as possible, probably next year with the legislation. So, Chairperson, sorry that there was no PowerPoint, but that was my attempt to kind of set the scene. And then, with your permission, Dr. Kurtz, that will then lead the presentation on some of the detail of what now is being proposed in terms of the road accident benefit scheme. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Chairperson, good morning, colleagues and members of the portfolio committee. Thank you for our Deputy Minister for the excellent scene setting, and I think we can all grasp the importance and the urgency of this matter today. With your permission, I would just like to introduce my team. Mr. Pillay, on my far left, the Acting Chief Director for Public Entity Oversight from the Department. Mr. Gao, who is the project leader for the No-Fault Road Accident Benefit Scheme. And I would also like to introduce the support from the Road Accident Fund officials here, the CFO, Mr. André Hernandt, and also the executive legal member, and that is Ms. Lindsay Steele. I will allow Mr. Gao to do the presentation, but I would just like to flag the following issues. We are not coming up with something that we've invented overnight and now want to introduce to the portfolio committee. The important trends that we've experienced and to which the Deputy Minister referred to over the last 10 years was that we are creating something and over time we actually realize that it is too costly to manage. But unfortunately, once you've created something, and this animal we've created in 1942, in time we realize that we can't just take away rights that have existed over a long period of time. But we need to manage it. We need to have a pretty good idea of why we are doing it. And in the end, we need to promote the public's interest. Now, within the priority areas of this government, I need to emphasize that we are promoting an integrated social security system. And the no-fault policy within the Road Accident Fund will be one of the very important pillars of the system. Secondly, the reason why we introduced Road Accident Fund scheme from the very beginning was to support those victims who do not have a possibility or redress of getting some successful claims against the guilty party in an accident. And that is why the government stepped in through the Road Accident Fund. So the second very important matter that we want to introduce is the national health insurance boost that the Road Accident Fund No-Fault Policy will ensure. We need to put our money where our mouth is. As the Deputy explained, presently a very large sum of government money is going to specialists, going to lawyers and into administration costs. I think the latest figure is around 48%. And the reason for that is because we have very litigious and complex environment in which we need to operate. We We cannot afford that, and as a country that is not addressing the reason why we've introduced that. So within the health sector, there is a need to actually make it possible for your health professionals and your service providers to assist victims immediately. We are talking about trauma support. We are talking about emergency medical care. And then, very important, we are introducing a policy shift from being dependent and receiving handouts from government to taking hands and rehabilitating into society. That is the extension of the health support that we would like to introduce, emphasizing the very complexity of working together as a government and as a private sector. Within government, the support throughout the health department and treasury, and also from social development, I would like to commend. We went through very difficult and sometimes very technical discussions, because we didn't want to come here, Chairperson, today and present a document that has not been thought through. I'm quite convinced today that we will not have agreement from all areas in the country, especially maybe from the legal fraternity. But we have one responsibility, and that is to be answerable to our greater public. Everyone that pays petrol is paying and contributing to the petrol levy, which is basically the only income of the Road Accident Fund. If they do not have enough money to settle claims, we need to address the way in which that that entity will be funded. Chair, before we go into the actual detail of the policy, I would like to just highlight the areas that we are intentionally going to change. The restructuring effort already started in 2008, where we introduced the cappings. All right. We've also introduced the limitation of claims for non-pecuniary loss. All right. So we introduced the very nature of a serious injury. That has been dealt with. Now we're in a second phase, and we are addressing this very important thing of the governance structure of the Road Accident Fund, trying to include all role players. We are talking to the funding of the Road Accident Fund and the possibilities. We are trying to explain the legitimate way in which we will enhance the cover also to people at fault. In that regard, you will see that it will be focused on emergency medical care. It will be focused on trauma care. And you will also notice some exclusions that we are still introducing. Chairperson, without further ado, can I introduce Mr. Gow? Please take us through. Thank you.
Before he does that, I have just received a letter of apology from Mr. Modisa, the CEO of the Road Accident Fund. He was supposed to be with us today. He is ill, and he has been advised by his doctor to not to travel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The members who have received the draft policy will note that it's an extremely long, and for those who are not versed in Road Accident Fund matters, fairly complex to grasp. So the purpose of this presentation is to try and explain where we're coming from and where we're going to in a fairly simple manner. And then afterwards we will probably be dealing with questions through the Deputy Minister. So thank you very much for the opportunity. When we published the document, we have been working on a shortened version as well, a slightly condensed version that we envisage would be published alongside the the full-length policy document for those people who don't want to spend the time reading the full 90 pages. So that we're also working on. The purpose today is to brief the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee and to explain why we want to move away from the current false-based system to a system which is based on principles of social security, where we have a safety net for those individuals who happen to be caught up without any compensation, as currently happens. So this net would catch some individuals who currently have no cover. And so we would really like to obtain your support going forward for this process. I think we should start by saying what the RAF actually does, because transport is a large area. There are many aspects. There's rail, air, sea. And then there's this entity called the Road Accident Fund, which doesn't seem to quite fit in there. And that's because it doesn't deal with transport as such. It deals with compensation. And it pays compensation for people wrongfully injured by the driving of motor vehicles. So this is a different type of an entity within the transport sector. It's funded by a levy on fuel, and it's based on insurance principles. Since 1942, or when the first Act came in 1946, the whole system was based on the idea of insurance, where a premium was paid to insure and indemnify. And that system is not aligned to the principles of social security and a security net, which aims to provide benefits. Now, the other thing that is important is to note that what the RAF is paying for is bodily injury. It also does not compensate for items which are in law not regarded as part of your body. So if your spectacles or your false teeth or your wheelchair or your artificial limb is damaged in the collision, that's not paid for because that's not regarded as part of your body. And that's one of the items that one must bear in mind. And one must also bear in mind that it doesn't pay for any of the damages to vehicles. This is purely a personal injury situation. Now, currently, the RAF pays the following types of compensation. And it's not really necessary to go through all of them, but essentially somebody who's injured in a motor vehicle accident would end up wanting to claim one or more of these items. The second last item, general damages, since the 1st of August 2008, can only be claimed if one has suffered a serious injury. But prior to that, it was an item which was compensated and really was an expensive item, and doesn't actually serve any particular purpose when it comes to an individual. It's what the Satchel Commission called sorry money. And yes, we're sorry you've been injured, but does this money really compensate for any particular loss? It's not based on money. It's based on previous awards in court cases, and it's something which since August 2008 has fallen away, except in injuries where been seriously injured. So basically, the RAF pays for bodily injuries and it pays for death, where the breadwinner has been killed, then the dependents may also stand to claim. Most important to remember about all of these items which we've just discussed is that, again, it's a fault issue. Where there's fault on the person who wishes to claim, then the claim is at risk. So, the less at fault you are, the more you get, but it can become a risky business. And the problem with the risk is that you may not be at fault, but you might have to prove it, and you might not be able to find witnesses to help you fight your case. In terms of the current problems, which the Deputy Minister has gone through, number of these are inherent in the system. Treatment and payment are delayed, and they're delayed because we first have to find out who's to blame. So unless we know who's at fault, the RAF cannot merely pay out. That must be determined first. The system is very complex, and lawyers cannot agree as to where, who's at fault and how much should be paid, and that's why these matters end up in court. So if the lawyers can't agree, then it's very difficult for ordinary people to agree. There are a number of inequities. Historically, the poor have subsidized the rich, and that's unfortunately one of the inequities inherent in the system. The system is obviously not affordable, and there are what the RAFCEO has here presented as perverse incentives. In other words, it's in your advantage to prove that you can't walk, that you can't return to work, because then you can get more money out of the system. And we can't afford a system which rewards that type of behavior. We need to rehabilitate people. We need to get them back on their feet. Fast interventions. As the Deputy Minister has indicated, a number of things have been done and a number of aspects have been looked at. There have been 7 commissions of inquiry since 1942. There have been legislative interventions, many of them. The most recent one in 2005, those are the amendments which came into effect on the 1st of August 2008. And Dr. Kurt has mentioned some of the things that came into being. Those changes, although fundamental, are still only interim changes. They do not solve the inherent problem which exists in the system. These are merely interim interventions in order to try and address certain of the wrongs while we move towards a new direction. In terms of what has happened and what has led to the process change, this slide shows that starting in 1995 to where we are today, a number of things have happened. The most early being the white paper of 1995, and the most recent being the published strategy document on the restructuring of the Road Accident Fund as part of the Comprehensive Social Security Scheme in 2006. And that is how we get here today. This is not something, as Dr. Quirton, the Deputy Minister, said, came up yesterday. This is something that has come a long way. And basically, what are we saying? Where would we like to go? So we say we need to move towards no-fault benefits, to benefits where fault is not relevant, to where fault is not the guiding principle, and to where fault does not delay, hamper, or cost more. And that such a system should be based on social security principles. But there will be social policy exclusions. Certain types of injury, where they're self-inflicted and so on, may not be covered. So there will be instances where payment will not happen. And one instance which is proposed is, for example, drivers under the influence of alcohol. So it's not necessarily that everybody is going to be paid, but those who are obeying the law and minding their own business and end up in a motor vehicle accident, they will be covered. Again, the second point is very relevant. You will get access to medical care. You won't get paid cash. Currently, the RAF is a cash cow. And the idea is to provide medical care, and that money should not change hands via the patient, but should go directly to the medical service providers. We should also recognize earners and non-earners, because the current system does not recognize non-earners. Non-earners are not in a good position in terms of the current system, and this proposal has various instances where non-earners will stand to benefit where currently they won't. There will be thresholds, there will be ceilings, because no system is affordable without thresholds and ceilings, and there will be defined rules. In other words, so for certain benefits, you will have to wait before you receive any benefits for a period of 3 months. And so it encourages people to go back to work, particularly those people who are not seriously injured. It would be in their interest to go back to work rather than, as we discussed earlier, to follow the perverse incentive route and to pretend they can't go back to work when actually they can. The funeral benefits, again, will be flat rated. Currently, it's based on your standing in life and your level of income and so on, everybody gets treated the same. Further items would be your continued entitlement to benefits would be based on you doing something, going for rehabilitation, attending vocational programs so that you go back to work. The idea is to encourage recovery. The proposal is to deduct collateral benefits received from the unemployment insurance fund and the compensation for occupational injuries and diseases. And the other proposal is that it be fully funded. The current system is funded on what is called a pay-as-you-go. Fully funded means that the assets are set aside and they are used as and when necessary and that the funds are available. There are various implications for healthcare, for example, and the idea is to set aside funds for healthcare so that funds would be earmarked and paid across and that there would be certain minimum standards of care that would have to be delivered and that there would be monitoring and that there would be alcohol tests on drivers in order to determine whether or not they should be able to claim. There's been a very wide consultation of affected stakeholders in terms of government. As you can see, we have consulted with health and all of the bodies mentioned on the slide. So it's been a long process of getting buy-in and testing what we are proposing against what some of our partners would like us to do. Now, what everybody would like to know is what are the financial implications, because if you're providing a higher a level of benefits to a larger number of people, what would the implications be? So those have been costed, and the two figures that we get at the bottom of the slide are determined by fuel sales. What the economists have found is that when the fuel price goes up, people use less fuel, so that affects the pricing. But it ranges on the estimates in 2009 terms between roughly 60 and 68 cents a litre. And of course, as we've said, that money then mostly goes to the affected people and not intermediaries. So, to conclude then, what we are requesting is that the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee notes the publication or the impending publication of the draft policy and that you please support the part of the process going forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any additions?
I think we would, if there are questions or some clarifications, we'd certainly like to be available to answer.
I now open the opportunity for members to ask questions. Honorable Taro.
Such a concise manner. I've just got one thing which I seems to be lacking out of the proposals, and it really relates to the policy shift that's going to have to take place from an official type of agency into one where I would think it becomes more administration. Mr. Gard did mention some sort of a restructuring, but that's going to be something that we're going to have to tackle up front. What is the implications of reducing 1,600 odd lawyers into clocked? And that has serious, you know, implications along the way. And I think that we need to just take heed of what that is going to be, because where services are now going to be rendered through the Road Act Fund, as I understand, in terms of the maybe even medical legal type services, they're going to be done now by the state. So I see this as a big area where we need to just focus on. The second thing would be then is to take in, you know, the whole model forward. It's all very well us sitting here and amending the acts and mental, even if it is. And I'd like to get clarity. Is this going to be a new act, or are we going to start fiddling as we always hate to do with the existing? because if we're going to go in a new paradigm shift, my feeling is that we should come up with a brand new bill and get rid of what we had, because this fit in between creates sort of problems down the line, and we saw that recently with the amendments. But we need to get a funding model up front, which is going to now take this process into a new horizon, put it that way. And bearing in mind that, I think, Madam Chair, just for updating, because, I mean, you were not, or might have been here partly when we were presented with the Commission's report, which is a 902 pages of Cathy Satchel stuff. There's a lot of implications there which, you know, ask questions of us now. And we obviously will deal with this as we go along, but it requires us to be fully informed as a new committee about the Planning Commission and about this strategy plan that I think you referred to, on about the second or third slide relating to the 206 one, because I don't seem to recollect that one, and I don't think we as a committee actually look too harshly at the Taylor Commission and its recommendations, because out of that is obviously then checking the capacities of those various government state institutions. Do they have ability to deliver on the welfare side, which, you know, they're battling with themselves at the moment, on the other hand, on the health side? So I'm just flagging these questions clearly because, they're there. We all know that. But, you know, they're not being addressed, and it may be something we need to thrash out in the process going forward. And then, finally, the other thing which this committee has been begging for and hasn't seen is the implications of the definition of the serious injury. That was meant to be a regulatory issue, which was to come back to this committee, and my deputy minister will recall it when he was previous chair. We never actually got that. And clearly, I raise it for the simple reason that I always use as an analogy. You know, the pianist losing a finger versus me losing a hand. I mean, are two different things. And whether that does have impact in terms of the new no-fault system and whether with the capping it doesn't make any difference anyway, but I need to know clarity in my own mind about that as to what is going to happen to that particular aspect of it. Chair, I'll leave it there, knowing full well the implications of this thing, and hope that we will have obviously time to interact as much as possible after the draft legislation comes to this House with in the way of public hearings again, because it was such an extensive program last time, as the Deputy Minister will recall, but there is a whole lot of people out there just waiting to pounce from a legal approach vis-a-vis some of the common law issues, you know, which still hang in the balance there, and we don't know whether, you know, those matters have not been challenged yet, or are they being challenged? You know, I mean, I'll just put that to us as a couple of flags. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Can we revert back to our norm of asking three questions at a time, so that we can give other members an opportunity also to ask? In total, Honourable Faro, you asked six questions. No. It is one question that is divided into six. So you would get six different answers. I was writing what you were asking, and I made a point of each and every thing that you referred to. So let us limit and also take into consideration that we have different views, so that we can begin to hear what other people from different backgrounds are looking at this. Thank you. Can I invite other members? Honorable Mabila Ngwenya.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by thanking the Deputy Minister and also the officials from the department for the presentation made. Chair, I think we welcome the proposal because it's going to address some of the concerns that we had as we keep on raising as this committee. But Chair, let me just raise a few issues for clarity. There was this concern that we have raised as a committee. I don't know where it's going to be allocated in this
his proposal, the one of paying the foreign visitors, when you compensate them, you don't use the South African currency. You use their own currency, which at the end of the day makes the fund to spend more money to one person, because that person has not been compensated according to the South African currency, but you use the currency of that particular, of the country where the victim is coming from. Where is it going to be allocated in this proposal? Because I think this proposal is trying to address some of the loopholes or the gaps that existed in the previous the act. Here, Chairperson, we're talking about the drivers. That if the driver has been tested and you find that the driver was under the influence of liquor, that driver will not be compensated. But on the other side, you find that there are also passengers who are victims, ordinary passengers who are victims. If that passenger has been tested, that he or she has been knocked down by the car because that passenger was, that pedestrian was under the influence of liquor, where do we place that particular person? Do you treat that particular person as you treat the driver, or maybe there will be a separate I don't know, a separate way in which you will address that particular matter. Chair, on the stakeholders that have been consulted, I don't know where are you fitting this the taxi association. Are they not part of your stakeholders, or maybe they will be given a chance when you publish this in the government gazette for them to comment, because we know that you're dealing with a difficult industry which must be engaged physically, where you have to explain some of the things so that they take that information to their branches or whatsoever. Where are you expecting to get the comments from the association, the taxi associations, the bus associations, as well, aware that most of the accidents are being caused, although they deny it, but taxis and also buses, you know them, Lord Doding, where do you allow them to fit in this proposal so that we hear their comments? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Deputy.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I only got the draft policy paper this morning, so my apologies. Had I heard it earlier, I would have been more prepared. So if I am asking questions that the answers are in here, please tell me and I will read them up. I'll try and stick to your three questions, Madam Chair. The first is, I'm presuming, this may be a silly question, that there's been a cost analysis of what this new policy would do in comparison to what it's doing now, a detailed cost analysis and a funding model. And if so, could we have a copy if it's not in this draft policy? The second is, once this new legislation comes in, I'm presuming there's going to be some kind of phasing over where you've got existing cases from the old legislation to the new. How would that be handled? I'm sure it's going to be a bit of turmoil at that time. I'd be interested to find out about that. And then, am I right in saying that experiences and work done in previous commissions that are good points to make and use are included in this policy document? And one quick one is, have we looked at also international experiences in other countries where they had similar situations, have we taken that on board as well? Thank you.
Are there any comments or questions from members of the portfolio committee? If there are none, I would then give to the department to respond.
And then we'll refer obviously some of the details where the colleagues from the department, or perhaps even from the Road Accident Fund, who are better equipped to answer some of the details. You're right, I calculated it as five, but in fact you're right, it was six questions that Stuart posed. Maybe it's a build-up of frustration from his side. over many years. The yes, indeed, there are. The first question that he asked was, yes, indeed, there are issues around the current staffing of the Road Accident Fund and any transition. Because clearly a road accident benefits scheme agency will, or authority will have a different kind of employment profile. If we're moving away from a very fault-based, litigious, court-based kind of system to a more healing, recuperation, and restitution approach, we're moving towards kind of a social case, a social work case almost approach. And therefore, certainly the profile and character of the fund's employees are likely to change. We've already had some preliminary discussions with the trade union, the majority trade union in the fund. And have alerted them to these issues, and obviously are engaging with them around the policy document and the implications. But part of the issue then relates to, I think it was the first or second question that the Honourable De Freitas asked, and that is that obviously once one brings in a RADSA, it doesn't mean that suddenly the Road Accident Fund itself disappears, because it will have, and it's still got a very significant caseload. And so you can't make claims that have been placed in terms of the current legislation, you know, retroactively changed, and suddenly they come under. We would have to do justice to them in terms of the current Road Accident Fund legislation. So we anticipate a lengthy, unfortunately, but lengthy running down, as we're calling it, phasing out period, a kind of sunset clause period on the Road Accident Fund. But that's not to dodge the issue of there will be staff and work employee-related issues which we need to be sensitive to, but obviously not at the expense of rising to the issues of public interest, which is what it's overwhelmingly about. Absolutely, in terms of the second question that Stuart asked, absolutely our intention is not to have an amendment act and so on, but a foundational act, if you like, that to set in motion a road accident benefit scheme. We might have to consider, you know, running repairs, as it were, to the Road Accident Fund, bearing in mind that it's not about to evaporate. And so that we might still need to introduce some further amendments, but those would be, as Mr. Gow correctly said, of the same kind as the previous amendment acts that we introduced. There will be kind of, you know, propping up something, but fundamentally there needs to be a massive institutional change, and we will address that. The funding model up front, we certainly have discussed that, so that was also a question that the Honourable De Freitas raised. We are indeed, you know, we're certainly going into this, and we're certainly Treasury has been looking very closely at this and has been assisting us to develop the funding model. And some indication of that is provided in the larger document, in the policy document. It's an important chapter in the document. Obviously, a very important question that needs to be asked. I think it was not just that the Honourable De Freitas was only got the document this morning, but I think he went out to get some tea. So there was a brief presentation. At that moment, I think he went out to get some tea. When it came to costing, but essentially, the indications are that it would require a slight increase in today's prices of the fuel levy, but not a huge increase. And maybe someone else has got a better sense of it. But it's of the order of, depending on how much fuel is being purchased, obviously, of the order of about 6. Yeah, it would come to about 60 and 68, and the current fuel levy is 64. So you can see it's pretty much within the same range, we think. Obviously, a lot depends on the other ancillary thing, which we must always bear in mind, not least as the Department of Transport. Our best contribution to this is not increasing the fuel levy, but bringing down the fatalities and injuries on our roads and so forth, and that's a big battle. So we mustn't get lost in this and forget that other, perhaps the key task that we have as the Department of Transport, along with the rest of the citizens of South Africa, because it's not the Department of Transport that's driving all the cars that has all the accidents, but it's a massive joint effort that we need to make. The other point we want to make about the cost, which Mr. Gow made, is remember that if we get this right, and we must, then a lot of this money that we will then collect for the fuel levy and that will go into benefits paid out is money that is already being budgeted in for health, for instance. So we think that if we'll actually be saving money in the end rather than loading up more money in terms of the fuel levy, if indeed the levy might have to increase marginally. And the figures suggest that maybe it won't. Capacity of state institutions was, I think, the fourth question that Stuart asked. We all know that there are challenges in this front, the capacity of our public sector generally, and related institutions like a future RAPS. The good news is that we think that, first of all, we think that the road accident funds capacities have increased, that their funding hasn't increased, and that's the battle at the moment. So we think that there's a bit of a good news story in terms of the sort of managerial competence, the ability to process claims and so on. The reason for backlogs currently is just that there's insufficient funding to meet the overwhelming avalanche of claims that we've got. But the RAPSA, when it's set up, will have a much lighter administrative footprint. And that's very much the intention. As we keep repeating, a lot of the road accident fund problems are precisely the nature of the area that it's dealing with, the number of staff that it needs to employ, the number, the complicated cases, legal cases it's dealing with, and so on. If we shift to a whole different dispensation, we anticipate a much lighter administrative cost for the RAPSA, and a lighter touch generally. Of course, that's still no guarantee that it won't be cumbersome and useless. And, bureaucracies worldwide, including in South Africa, have their challenges, and it's something we'll have to watch very carefully. Where are we on the definition of serious injury? Others will answer that. But indeed, the whole modelling, and this will be one of the areas when we get to the legislation, around how we award and calculate benefits. There will be defined benefits, and how you define benefits in terms of injury is obviously a complicated and often disputed area. So it's not something we're going to be able to dodge, and we're going to have to deal with. And this committee, is going to hear a lot of inputs, I think, in next year if we get to the legislation in this area. But the current process and others who are involved in it will have a sense on that. Where are we on the Stuart's last question was the prohibition on access to the common law, prohibition on going to courts to recover the balance of a compensation. So what we did in the Amendment Act, and again it was a disputed matter, was to say that we are removing the ability of people who feel that they were not at fault, they were injured or whatever, and what they've got doesn't fully compensate them for what has happened to them, and they would want to go to court and exercise their general constitutional right to go to the court to seek the balance of compensation from the party that was responsible for the accident, for instance. In the Amendment Act, we removed that right on the grounds that we for various reasons. Again, that is something that is with the courts currently. The intention is to, in a different form, to maintain that provision. What will be useful for us, hopefully, as legislatures and as the executive, is that hopefully this matter will be settled in the Constitutional Court in regard to the Road Accident Fund Amendment, which would then provide us guidance with whether we should want to retain it or not. So hopefully the court process is going to take a long time, but we and it's not yet at the Constitutional Court, but both sides. Either way, it goes in the Pretoria. It is now in the Constitutional Court. had many challenges with the Road Accident Fund, and huge claims, some of which have gone into the media. There's the famous Swiss citizen case. That is why one of our approach to that matter, to try to deal with that matter, was that it was too late for the Swiss national in case, was one of the key reasons why we introduced a cap ceiling on claims that people could make in terms of future loss of earnings. Wasn't in place before the claim was submitted in the case of the Swiss national, and so it couldn't apply. So there's now a cap, and that cap is also based in rand currency. Okay. So it's not as though it will be calculated in some other way. Currently, as far as I know, in the proposal, we are not making a distinction between South African citizens and not. Okay. I'm advised that maybe you should. The idea is that we would pay medical expenses, but not other claims like future loss of earnings and so on. So in the RAMSA, we would cover anyone medically injured for the emergency side of treatment. Thank you. Okay, thanks for that. Speaking under correction, and they'll correct me very quickly. When we floated this idea, many have argued publicly that the danger of moving towards a no-fault system is that you might encourage bad behavior, on the road. Now, I don't know of anyone who's got drunk with a view to going out and having an accident, but maybe that happens. So I think generally, but nonetheless, we are sensitive. And that's why we've introduced some social exception. So we're saying it's no fault, but except in certain cases. Obviously, someone who hijacks a car and then causes an accident and injures himself seriously and so forth. Even there, someone who's drunk under the influence of alcohol or drugs, someone who doesn't have a valid license, someone involved in something like hijacking a car, whatever, even in those cases, under the proposal we've got, we will meet their immediate emergency treatment. So we'll deal with that, so we won't get into disputes about that. The thing is to, you know, because maybe the person wasn't hijacking the car, so let's deal with it, let's pay for it. Not the individual, but we pay the healthcare providers to treat the person. But then when it comes to other benefits, if it can be shown that the person was driving under the influence of alcohol, for instance, driving, so that doesn't apply to passengers or other things. Some a drunk minibus driver or whatever is one thing, but the passengers, we won't be looking at their, you know, I don't imagine. We stakeholders consulted. Yes, for the moment, we've fundamentally been consulting with government departments. We're now moving into the stage of consulting with a broader range of stakeholders and inviting comments from anyone who wants to comment on it. But also we will proactively reach out to some of the key stakeholders. And I think the last question was the last question that the Honourable De Freitas asked, and that was, are we building on previous commissions and have we looked at international examples? And the answer is yes. Very much so, particularly the first thing, very much. This is not, as we've been saying, out of the blue. This is very much finally actually trying to move from the Thatchell Commission in particular to get to legislation, and this is the intermediary step in that. But also, obviously, we've been looking at international examples, and maybe some of my colleagues might be able to talk to some international examples.
They will
free to contradict anything I've said. And to point out that some of the things that are nonsense. Dr. Kurup.
Thank you. Now, I think we've been covering all the questions. The one, just on clarity point, the 2005 Act is, of course, the one that got implemented as an amendment to the RAF Act in 2008. And then with regard to the Taylor Committee and all the other commissions, yes, we are most willing to come and brief the Portfolio Committee on the contents of those documents. The Taylor Committee in particular dealing with the social security, comprehensive social security system of the country, which is very important and quite tricky to get together. Because as the Deputy Minister indicated, we are dealing with COID, we are dealing with the UIF, and all these social security, applicable systems in the country, even SASA, we need to make sure that we are comprehensively applying the same principles. So that is quite important. As a government, we collectively look at that. And if the committee would like a briefing, we can definitely arrange that. On the exceptions, yes, very important that the Deputy Minister mentioned the exceptions and also self-infliction of harm. So if you go out and you try to get killed as a result you would like to claim, that will not help. The consultation process, very important. Yes, we've tried to consult even before coming here, and from the department side, I would like to emphasize that when we finally draft the new poll, that is when the big debate will start. Because now we are talking about broad policy principles. We unpack it so that it is comprehensible for every stakeholder to actively engage us. We are going out, and that is the view, Chairperson, that we would like to present today. We are going out there. We know what we want to achieve. It's quite clear. The path has been set. But to realize that and address the structural implications, the operational and system challenges, is we need to formulate a very good new act that will stand the test of time. And for that, we would like to request comments from all spheres of society and all the different stakeholders. So when we publish on the 12th, Mr. Gow, I think, then we will allow for adequate time to present those comments to the department. And I would like to urge all members, even of this committee, once you've read through the document and you have new ideas and new questions, we are there, we are available. We would like to work together and see that we have the best product to benefit society in the end. I think there was just one question. Oh, yes, on the serious injury, did I? Yes, I think we have, of course, there will be no general damages in the end, so that whole issue will not be applicable anymore.
Thank you very much. Are there any comments? If there are none, we would like to take this opportunity to thank both the Minister and the Department for a presentation, and we appreciate that you have come to brief us on this, and we will be gearing our bolts and oiling our our joints so that we can then meet the challenge. Thank you very much. Can we then move to the second item of our agenda, which is the consideration and the adoption of the previous minutes. I think the minutes that are here are for the 27th of October. Do you have copies of the minutes? We are still considering the minutes of the 27th of October. Thank you. We are on page 1. Pardon me? Oh, okay.
we check if we all have the minutes. We have three sets of minutes. The first one is the minute of the 13th of October, which was a joint sitting between the Portfolio Committee of Transport and Energy.
I would have no idea as to whether they get the minutes, because the minutes belong to us. But what needs to happen is that from our side, we need to inform them of what decisions we have taken, not necessarily to give them the minutes, but also to engage with them on the basis of the resolutions that we would have taken. Thank you. We are adopting the minutes of the 27th of October. Is there any second for that? Seconded. Thank you. Then we are on the minute of the 20th of October, we are moving backwards. It was a joint meeting.
On page 2, on the second last line, they refer to the CAA and the fact that the National Lottery has established a program. I don't recall that, and I don't think the National Lottery would be promoting some sort of initiative to empower students. Because they are really looking, I think, at charity organizations and distributing funds to that level. I could be wrong, but I don't remember the National Lottery being used there. Maybe it was somebody else, National Treasury or something. It just doesn't ring a bell with me. I don't know whether we can have a look at that to see whether it's the correct agency to establish those programs.
Okay, we'll look at that. Maybe it is the phrasing of the comment here. Other than that,
last page, last line on page 4. I think that word should be poaching, not porching. The ATNS should address the challenge experienced as a result of poaching the air traffic control. I think it's poaching.
Do we have a mover and a second? Thank you. Second? Thank you. Can we then move to the minute of the 13th October? Thank you. Noting that, can we then move to the program? Honourable Justice?
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's an oversight on your side. I've also got minutes for the 3rd of November and the 17th of November. I don't know if...
Yeah, here we have only the ones for the 13th of October, 20th of October, and 27th of October. Of November. I don't have the copies with me.
Madam Chair, if I may just say, it was in our envelopes, so I don't know why you
didn't get them. I'm only getting them now. I do apologize for the committee secretary. In actual fact, he was only informed today at 11 o'clock that he belongs to this committee. So he didn't get any opportunity of looking at whether we all received what we were supposed to receive. And I also think that the former secretary of the committee did her best, because she was phoning every day to try and establish if a new secretary has been appointed until she left. Even yesterday she was still worried and phoning. So it's not a fault of them. Thank you. Can we then go to the minute of the 3rd of November? Honorable Tiflis.
I'm proposing, but what I'd like to just ask is similar to what Honorable Ferrer mentioned earlier. For example, on page 3 in the resolutions, there's a whole lot of bullet points where we've asked the department for various information and so forth. So if I could ask you through your officers to perhaps, you know, write to them, because as you say, otherwise they're just resolutions on paper. Thank you.
Yes. What I would also recommend is that we don't make resolutions. We don't put resolutions. We don't put bullet points on resolutions. We must number the resolutions so that we would know that we are referring to resolution 1, resolution 2, or resolution 3. Thank you.
Chair, just a question mark on bullet number 3 under paragraph 2 on page 2. It says there the department had an approved organizational structure for 103, of which it says RAND 671, where I think that R doesn't reflect monetary numbers, it's more just numbers, if I'm correct. So that just needs to be rectified.
Can we then have a mover and a seconder? Honorable Defensor, seconded by Mavila. Wait. Can we then go to the minutes of the 17th of October, of November, I'm sorry.
No, Madam Chair, just also in this case, there are a whole lot of different things that we ask the department to achieve. So when we write to them, thank you.
Yes. What will happen is that we will first have our workshop where we will be picking up all the resolutions that we have taken and then put them on the program, so that by the time we write to the department, we are clear as to when we would want them to respond, because we are having a meeting on such and such a day dealing with that matter, so that we have a sequence of events that we are following. Thank you. Can we have then a mover and a seconder for them? The first, Mabila, thank you. Can we go to the program? What happened was that both myself and Buyoga met sometime in January to look at what we would do in the first 3 months of this year. But when we go to the workshop, we would be looking at a program for the whole year, because maybe we think that by that time we shall have be made aware of when the first term, first session, second session, third, and so forth would be, so that we can then begin to slot. So what is presented today is a proposed program.